And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Seth Arnes.
And today we go deep into the world of insects with science author Margie Patlack. Margie has authored several books, including her latest Insect Safari, where she shares scientific findings that reveal there's more to the inner lives and behaviors of insects than we ever thought possible. Margie, welcome to This Green Earth.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. I love spouting off about bugs.
Oh, well, excellent. Then you are in good hands here because we love hearing about it. Now, you have penned books about encounters with the natural world, and you focus a lot on intimate moments with the Maine coastline. And in Insect Safari, you take another focused, intimate approach to the world of insects, naming a specific encounter with a tricolored bee as kind of your inspiration into this fascination with insects. And being a science writer, you already had that foundation. So can you share with us that encounter and how it set you on this safari?
Yeah, well, I wasn't a real big bug lover before I started the book and had that encounter. And I had usual distaste for stinging and biting insects and was a little put off by their alien features. I mean, think about it, all outer space aliens are depicted like some insect or another.
But
what set me off was all the talk about the honeybee colony collapse disorder and the more lurking insect apocalypse that people were talking about because so many insect species were decreasing in number. And that made me realize that I really don't know that much about insects, and I wanted to protect them because I did know that they're, you know, comprised 4 out of 5 of every animal species on the planet. So this was a big area of nature that even though I had written a previous book about it, nature in general, I hadn't tackled. So I thought, well, I better be more mindful of insects. And in if I'm more mindful, then not only will my world expand immensely, but I'll be motivated to protect them. And so the first insect that I spotted, you know, first I had radar out for bees because of the talk about the lack of bees. And it was this, you know, cute, endearing little bumblebee that was so furry and cuddly that I guess I was more drawn to it. But then I expanded using a wonderful app called iNaturalist that helped me identify the insects. And then once I got to know them by name, I became curious about what their lives were like. Where did they live? How did they find mates? What did they eat? I mean, most of us know a lot of information about animals that we never even encounter. Like we know what lions eat, for example, or where bears hibernate, or where baby birds nest. But if you try to answer those questions for a lot of the insects that are around us and are really common, most of us don't know the answers to that. So I was guilty as charged. And so I started using my science writing skills to just basically research and interpret the scientific jargon of what I was researching to answer my questions. But really the driving force was a curiosity about these insects. And then once I got the answers that I wanted, I was just flabbergasted. I mean, who knew that, you know, ants can recognize themselves in mirrors and tend to their wounded brethren, or that bees like to play with balls and can count, or even the little fruit fly deliberates over his mating choices. So I kept on finding all this fascinating information. Then I said, well, I've got to write this down and share it with other people because this is too exciting not to share. You know, my shout out is basically my book, Insect Safari.
Yeah. So you started down a road a little bit that I think is really interesting because I know I'm very guilty sometimes of anthropomorphizing animals and insects. And we kind of put our human emotion on animals or behaviors. But in your book, you do put in some scientific facts about behaviors that feel very familiar to our reactions as humans, like fruit flies mulling over mating choices and male flies drinking more alcohol when rejected. Things of that nature are really fascinating. So what do you think about an insect's emotional architecture?
Right. I mean, I think insects are having their moment now because there's just so much research being done on them. And they used to think that, you know, with their little bitty brains, they couldn't accomplish much. But lo and behold, when they started to look at how their brains were designed and the fabulous architecture it has, that it made a lot of researchers realize that maybe our brains weren't so well designed after all, because these insects are able to do so much with so few brain cells. So that's part of it. And then they've started to actually do tests to figure this out. It's not like they're projecting, oh, I think this insect is doing it and I'm observing it. They're testing these insects in a scientific manner to find out their ability to decide over mates, for example, or, you know, a bee's ability to navigate from its nest to its site where it gets flowers. It turns out it depends on counting, and they figured that out in a very, you know, wonderful experimental way. So there's a lot of science that's just being applied now and coming out with amazing discoveries. But the other thing I want to point out is perhaps a bigger danger than anthropomorphizing is some people call anthropodenial, which is denying other animals of the capabilities that we have. And there's no reason to think that even these tiny animals don't share a lot of the emotions and intellectual capabilities that we have, because they're all necessary for survival. So they start at a very early stage of evolution. We need our emotions because we need to find what we need in the world. And that starts very early on, right? So it's not surprising, actually, that they're finding these things.
Yeah, it's super interesting.
Yeah, like others, I'm guilty of anthropomorphizing animals, my dog especially. So I'm really curious about this insects and emotions. I think as a biologist, I sort of think as life gets smaller and smaller, like we talked about, the capacity for some of higher reasoning and emotions is perhaps not there. So can you talk a little bit more about some evidence that scientists are finding about actual having emotions in the insects?
Emotions come from the most primitive part of our brains. And so, you know, creatures that have evolved many, many zillions of years ago started off with those basic primal elements in their brains. And emotions have an important role, like I said, in directing us to the food we need or the mate we need. And they're not just, you know, I'm really blue today. It's more like, I really need this, so I'm going to be happy when I get it so that I go and get it again. Or, you know, I'm going to avoid this thing because it hurts me. You know, those are just basic emotions that any animal that's moving has to have in order to survive in this world.
Right. We talk about that lizard brain sometimes, of those more instinctual sorts of elements and behaviors the animals have.
Right, yeah. And we have them too. And a lot of what goes on in our brains is in that unconscious section where we don't know what's happening, but we're responding instinctually oftentimes and making decisions before our, you know, upper reaches of our brain that we attribute to our intellectual capacities catch up. Oftentimes, you know, we just react in a really emotional way to something, and then we justify it with a rational response.
So as you're going through and picking out different insects, obviously our world has a plethora of different insects to choose from. How did you go about picking the ones that you wanted to examine further in your book?
It's funny because originally it was just whatever I saw, and just being curious about what, like I said, what their lives are like. I thought, well, I'll only write about the interesting ones. And it turns out that I found something interesting about almost every insect that most people don't know, just because they're just under people's radar, and also because the research is new and they're just discovering things. You know, whatever insect I found, I just started researching. So that's why it became everyday bugs, right? Because these were common insects. I wasn't choosing insects that you had to go on a safari in Africa to see. These were insects that are right in your backyard, which is, I think, the beauty of insect safari, because you'll find these insects out there that I'm talking about in my book, because they're really common.
I love the idea that we can go in our own backyard and it's a world of discovery. We had a recent Utah professor who came on the show and talked about an ant that he discovered that was an actual ant discovery in his own backyard in Salt Lake City. So I do love the idea of an insect safari in your own backyard and breaking down some of the more interesting things about these insects and their biology and their anatomy. Maybe talk about a couple that really sit with you that you learned something about you wouldn't have otherwise going deeper into research for this book.
Yeah, so maybe we'll start off with the green bottle fly, because those are really common insects that everybody has seen, but they tend to avert their eyes from them. And I did as well, because they usually show up on like dog poop or dead bodies. But it turns out that they have a really important role in decomposing things. And if it wasn't for them, you know, we'd be tripping over dead bodies and poop everywhere. So I learned to appreciate them for that reason. But another reason that I learned to appreciate them that I didn't expect was when I went to zoom in on them to take a picture, because I like to take close-up pictures for my book so people can have up-close and personal encounters with insects, I realized how gorgeous they are. I mean, they're like this iridescent bluish, greenish, turquoise color, and they have these beautiful black markings that contrast. So I also learned to appreciate it from that standpoint. And then, you know, like any other insect that I've encountered, it has, you know, a special superpower. So it can smell a meal from 10 miles away, which is really incredible. It's, you know, it's like the equivalent of you being in the city and smelling, you know, your spouse's hamburgers cooking out in the suburbs or something. So it can home in on things from really far away, which is why they arrive so quickly after something dies or after there's a poop that needs to be decomposed. And I think the other thing that I was intrigued by was that the male green bottle fly can detect how fertile a female is just by noting how often she glints in the sunlight, because it has to do with how fast she's flapping her wings, which has to do with how vigorous, you know, and healthy she is. But essentially, they're tracking this, which is I think is amazing. And it also explains why there's no rainy day sex for them. And the other thing I discovered is that they're being used in healthcare. So they're so good at just eating dead tissue and leaving healthy tissue alone that they use them to get rid of the dead tissue in these wounds that are hard to heal, and people who are diabetic or have other conditions that make their wounds hard to heal. And they actually create tea bags of their larvae, their babies that do this, and they apply them to wounds. So I thought that was pretty amazing. Probably the first insect that I really became fascinated and appreciated even before I started working on the book was the dragonfly, because when I was doing research for my master's degree in a marsh, I was completely swamped by a swarm of mosquitoes that were biting me, and I was getting really annoyed. And then all of a sudden, a herd of dragonflies just like zipped in, and within a minute, they had gotten rid of all the mosquitoes in the marsh that were bothering me and became my best friends forever after that, right? But I was intrigued, like, how did they kill so many insects so fast? And the more I discovered about them, the more I was amazed. So it turns out they're able to accomplish it because they have those big bloated eyes, right, with many facets. And so that allows them to see forward, sideways. They can't see behind them, but they can see in any other direction. But they can move in any direction in space because they have two operating sets of wings that are independent of each other. So that allows them to zip around in any direction quickly and also to hover. They also have this amazing ability to see in slow motion because they see many more frames per second than we do. So that means that things go more slowly for them, and they see things that we would never even notice. So that's how all those factors combined explain how they have this 95% kill rate in insects, which is really amazing because lions, who are really fast, have a 25% kill rate. So, you know, they're impressive little guys. Probably another insect I should mention are the bees, just because they're so smart and they're such quick learners. I mean, you know, an adult bee only lives for about a month, maybe 6 weeks, most adult bees. But, you know, from just a few days of emerging from her nest, seeing the world essentially for the first time, she has to quickly figure out how to get to flowers nearby and also how to find her way back. And she does this within days. And it turns out that, you know, she uses certain things, like she actually counts certain landmarks to figure out where she's going. And she doesn't get put off course if it's a windy day or anything. Also, once she finds these flowers, she's got to figure out all the ins and outs of them, because every flower species has their own pathway for the bee, essentially, for her to find the nectar. And she does this pretty quickly. And she also will teach nectar shortcuts to her fellow bees, or even bees from another species. Like, researchers have observed honeybees learning from bumblebees how to find these nectar shortcuts by going to the outside of a flower that's long and tubular and just poking in there, as opposed to climbing into the flower. So they're really smart and quick learners. And that's another thing that I think is truly amazing and fascinating. But, you know, every insect has their incredible superpower, I discovered, you know, like moths that can see by starlight, or the ironclad beetle that can be run over by a car and survive. The more I learned about them, the more I was impressed with their superpowers, which actually are created by their weird anatomies. So, you know, the things that put us off about insects are the things that give them their superpowers.
You started off your journey into the insect world with thinking about the collapse in bee populations and other decreases in insect populations. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what you've learned about how global changes in climate, human development, conversion of land, these sorts of issues have affected insects, and maybe some stories that go along with some of those impacts and changes.
I don't think that it's fully understood why the populations are declining, but they're definitely declining. I mean, 40% of all insect species have declined over the past 30 years in number. And I think 25% of all bee species are, you know, in danger of extinction. 21 out of 5 butterfly species are in danger of extinction. And we've all observed this. You know, we've seen that there's less moths going on our windshields when we drive at night, or even the monarch butterflies aren't as common anymore. As to why, you know, there's a number of factors, and it's different for every insect. And mind you, not every insect is declining in number. Some are actually expanding. So the true effects of everything aren't fully known. But, you know, habitat is important for any insect, of course, and that's decreasing with all the development that is going on. And monocultures in agriculture also affect it, and especially when they use insecticides that get rid of the weeds, like the milkweed that the butterflies depend on. So, you know, that's a clear-cut example, and that's why everybody started to have milkweed in their garden to help counteract that. I think pesticides and herbicides, they are realizing that it's not just that they kill the insects outright, but that they also weaken them and affect their navigational abilities. And there's a concern that if we have too much of this, we're going to kill many insects. And of course, we already have. And then global warming also contributes to it, because like any other animal, insects are affected by fires and floods, and it destroys their homes and their lives or their livelihoods. So that's another big factor. Light pollution has been posited as a factor, because insects, especially moths, are drawn to lights, and they're not doing what they should be doing instead, like, you know, feeding on flowers and mating with others. So that's another reason that there's been a decline.
We've talked a lot about pesticides and insecticides here on the show, and the ripple effects that you alluded to that are happening because of it. It's not just that they are killing them in the moment, but then we're finding that if it's changing their behaviors or patterns or where they're going or how they're mating, then in turn, it affects that entire area or ecosystem if they're being eradicated. So what are some steps in our own gardens and backyards we and our listeners can take to help make them insect friendly and allow insects to do what they need to do in our own little tiny ecosystems around our homes?
Yeah, there's a lot that we can do. I have a chapter called If You Plant It, They Will Come, which I call shorthand gardening for grubs, because if you give insects their basic requirements, and those would be food, shelter, and protection from herbicides and pesticides, and a place to overwinter, which sort of goes under shelter, then they're going to do quite well. And, you know, I've always been a big gardener and sort of saw insects as the bane of my existence when they destroyed some of my flowers and stuff and my crops. But really, I've learned to change my attitude. And that's another big factor is changing attitude. So let's tackle them one by one. So food, a lot of insects have evolved over long periods of time with specific host plants that they like to eat. So we need to plant more native species so that we can feed them. Caterpillars are really picky eaters and will only eat specific things. So we need to be mindful of that, especially if you want to see butterflies in your yard. For example, fritillary butterflies are an orange and black butterfly that's very common up here in Maine. I discovered that their caterpillars will only dine on wild violet leaves. So I no longer weed them out of my garden for that reason, so I can have more fritillaries. But many insects are also generalists. You know, they'll eat anything that's got some nectar and pollen. So I would just try to provide as much flowers that you can. And of course, you know, vegetables flower too. So they use that as well. I think you need to also, if you have the space, plant trees and shrubs that they like oaks and maples. And elderberry and viburnum are known for being great hosts for a wide variety of insects. So those are good ones to plant. But you can go online and find out native plants that are appropriate for your area. You know, just give them something to eat, basically. Now, moving on to shelter, a lot of insects overwinter in leaves, either in, you know, rolled up in a leaf or attached to plant stems underneath a leaf. So don't rake your leaves, you know, and the other thing that insects do over the winter is they burrow down into the plant, you know, the old plant stems from dead vegetation or into the first, you know, few inches of the ground. So what I've started to do is no longer mulch with that, you know, heavy wood mulch in my garden, because that can hamper their activities and their ability to burrow in and come out of their burrows. And instead, I just rake the leaves from my trees onto the garden, and it's a very effective mulch and it gives them a place to overwinter. Another huge category of insects like beetles need to have dead wood to survive. So, you know, I don't get rid of any of fallen trees or anything. I just let those old snags be because I realize that they're home not just for those insects, but for the birds that eat them. So it's, you know, they're all part of the one big ecosystem that I like to make happy. We need to be more sharing of our gardens. They're not just for us, they're for the other critters. And it's not just the insects, because there's been a 30% decline in the number of songbirds that fly from the tropics. Those brightly colored warblers and stuff won't visit us anymore and sing their wonderful songs if they don't have the insects that are so abundant here during the growing season. So, you know, I do it not just for the insects, but because I like to hear the birds as well.
I have spent a lot of time in Maine myself, went to college there, and I'm curious how living part of the year on the coast of Maine has informed this book about insects and the kind of insects in that backyard.
Well, you know, I do live in a diverse ecosystem here in Maine, where we have a marsh, a coastline, a forest, and I have a big garden. So I see lots of different kinds of insects, but even when I'm back in Philadelphia and I just have a tiny little courtyard, I've had some amazing encounters with insects. So they don't need much green space to survive. So, for example, I was sitting out having coffee in my little courtyard, and it has just a tiny patch of dirt in it that I plant some herbs. And all of a sudden, this beautiful swallowtail butterfly came down and landed on my parsley that's there, because that's what the caterpillars like to eat. So it laid eggs on my parsley. And then I was able to see it, those eggs hatch and become caterpillars, and how those caterpillars changed. And I took one and put it in a jar and actually saw it emerge into a swallowtail. And another time, you know, I have a lot of pots of flowers. I was potting them and I looked down and I realized that there was an egg case of a praying mantis on my flower pot right in the middle of Philadelphia. And, lo and behold, a few weeks later, I saw a little tiny baby praying mantises in my yard. So they don't need much, and they're all around us. Whether you live in a rural area like I do or in the city, they're there, and they're delightful if you just know to look for them.
I love that we can find life in urban and rural settings, and we just have to take a minute to look for it and also do our parts to be stewards of it. And it sounds like you have a lot of ways in which we can better understand how to do that in our own backyards, whether we do live in a city or somewhere that has a more far-reaching green space. So, Margie Patlock, we are so happy that you joined us today on This Green Earth to talk about your new book, Insect Safari. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. This was great.
Thanks for joining us, Margie.